This is East End Inc. Today we present biographer and historian Anke Mühlstein talking about her literary biography, Monsieur Proust's Library. Ms. Mühlstein has twice received the History Prize of the French Academy for biographies of her ancestors, banker James de Rothschild and the explorer Cavelier de La Salle. Ms. Mühlstein was recorded in November 2012 at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor. She was introduced by Canio's Catherine Soka.
Tonight we're really happy to have back with us again Anke Mühlstein to celebrate the publication of Monsieur Proust's Library, published by The Other Press. The book celebrates the profound influence of great literature on one of the greatest writers of our time, Marcel Proust. We'll find out that Proust was a precocious reader from an early age, no surprise I'm sure. It seems that he almost found his true reality in the pages of books, more so perhaps than in and amongst his peers. So it's fitting that his own characters are also formed by books. As many of you know, Anke is a distinguished biographer herself. She's published many biographies, including biographies of Queen Victoria, of Elizabeth I, and Mary Stuart. She has won numerous prizes, including the Académie Française and the Goncourt Prize for Biography. We're thrilled to have her here. Please give a very warm welcome to Anke Mühlstein.
Now, the title of this book, Monsieur Proust's Library, can be taken as a sort of a teaser. Am I talking about his real books, or am I talking about virtual books? The answer is very easy. If I were talking about tangible volumes, my own book would be about a paragraph long, because Proust's books have not been preserved as a whole. And you might even say that Proust actually did not really have a personal library. He lived with his parents until the death of his mother in 1905. At that time, he was 34. And in the Proust household, there were a lot of books. I mean, as a normal bourgeois French household, all the classics were there. But there was more than the classics, because both his mother and his grandmother were very keen readers, very well-educated women. Both ladies knew German and English, and they were both very interested in contemporary literature and very active members of a lending library. So it was a friend of his mother, Madame Catus, who helped him find a new apartment and helped him move and install himself in new lodgings. Proust started furnishing his inner library at an early age. He was, of course, encouraged to read by his mother and his grandmother. And as the fictional grandmother says in the novel, light reading is as unwholesome as sweets and cakes. So he was given real authors to read, and he adored Théophile Gautier, Capitaine Fracas. Of course, he liked Alexandre Dumas and Jules Verne. He curiously discovered Robert Louis Stevenson at a very early age. He really loved Treasure Island, and then a bit later, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And then he said that he liked anything with policemen. And I always wondered whether it was then that he sort of got his knack, his unbelievable talent for hidden clues, because there are clues all over the place in search of a lost time. You know, the first time you read La Recherche, you go from surprise to surprise, because everybody seems to do very unexpected things and people turn out to be very different from what you originally thought they were going to be. Let's take the example of Saint-Loup. Saint-Loup, when you first meet him, is a dashing officer, madly in love with an actress. By the end of the novel, he turns out to be a homosexual. Five volumes before the actual revelation, the narrator says that Saint-Loup had three very close friends, so close that there were rumors about their intimacy, rumors that were false. But the curious thing is that if later on it was discovered that these rumors were true of all four, each of the quartet had been entirely in the dark as to the other three. Now, I'm not saying that the sentence is limpid, but still, there you are. You are told what's going to happen. And in the case of the prince, the same is true. He marries Madame Verdurin in the very last volume, but in the second volume, in A Budding Grove, the narrator comments on the fact that he is absolutely furious at the misalliance of one of his relatives, but he adds, he will not be so difficult when it will be time for him to remarry. But of course, the reader only notices these mysterious anticipations after a second or even a third, or rather a close reading. But let's go back to his childhood. So he was encouraged to read. He was encouraged to learn by heart. This was a skill that was required in French school, but not to the extent it was required if you lived with Madame Proust. For Madame Proust, classical quotations were the stuff of daily conversation. And it is a trait that Proust gave in the novel to the mother and the grandfather, who use these quotes as a sort of mysterious shorthand. But Madame Proust never lost the habit. And while she lay dying, practically unable to speak, she managed to mumble in order to console, to cheer up her weeping son, a line of Corneille, si vous n'êtes Romain, soyez digne de l'être. If you're not a Roman, at least be worthy of one. So Marcel attended first a small elementary school, and then he entered the lycée of his well-to-do neighborhood. His parents lived Boulevard Malesherbes. That is, the boulevard starts Rue Royale. You know, Rue Royale is the splendid street that adjoins Place de la Concorde to the Church of la Madeleine. And this was his school, the Lycée Condorcet, was considered a school for amateurs, for dilettantes, by the more serious schools of the left bank, the schools that were around the Sorbonne. And it was true that it is a school that never produced any great scientists or any scholars. The accent was definitely on artists. And the list of the alumni is pretty impressive at that point. I will give you the names of people that Proust might have known or had actually known. The Goncourt brothers, Bergson, Vigny, Verlaine, Toulouse-Lautrec, Vuillard, Cocteau, and Valéry. So you see, it was really a sort of artist's breeding ground. Now, I have to add that the school was very welcoming to Protestants and to Jews, and also that it had no borders. Now, that's important because the borders were generally ambitious, brilliant young provincial boys who came to Paris because they had a fellowship. But it sort of changed the atmosphere of the school. At Condorcet, you didn't have them. So as one of Marcel's classmates said later on, the atmosphere was more that of a club than that of a barrack. Now, Marcel read many more novels and much more foreign literature than his classmates for different reasons. The first reason was that he didn't do anything in math class, it was reported by one of his teachers. The second is that his parents allowed him to read whatever he wanted to. And the third one is that he had these terrible asthma attacks, so that he had to skip school very often. And of course, he had more time to read. And don't forget that in a French school, you are never given novels to read. You only read plays, poetry, or memoirs of very dead authors. So Proust started reading Pierre Loti. He read the Russians when he was quite young, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. He read Stevenson, as I mentioned before, and George Eliot, Thomas Hardy. He really was widely read. With his classmates, when they got a bit older, they launched literary reviews, reviews that only lasted one school year. And the names, they were called Revue Bleu, Verte ou Jaune, according to the paper on which they were mimeographed. And none of them have survived. But what has survived is the letters the boys wrote about each other, because they were very critical and quarreled violently. And at one point, Proust advises Halévy to stop trying to be original and to read Shakespeare, Shelley, Emerson, La Fontaine, Racine, Flaubert, Renan, and Baudelaire in order to clarify his own thoughts. Only by reading great authors can one understand that simplicity has infinite elegance and the lack of affectation inexpressible charms. So he finished his school years. He did his military service. He served only 1 year because he took advantage of a law that allowed young men who were well-educated and wealthy enough to buy their own equipment to enlist before their class and to do only 1 year instead of three. And the good thing for him also was that as he had still had these asthma attacks, he was allowed not to sleep in the barracks. So it was not as painful as one could have imagined. He came back to Paris, and then what did he do? Well, he wrote articles in different magazines about fashion, about art. Mainly, he read a lot. He wrote for himself. He explored the Parisian social scene. And that is really when he got this reputation of being himself a snob and a dilettante. Then came the extraordinary, bewildering experience of his discovery of Ruskin. Ruskin, I don't know if you have read Ruskin, I know I haven't. Ruskin is the British philosopher, but really Ruskin wrote about everything, about archaeology, botany, architecture, painting, sculpture. And he was, of course, not known at all in France, but Proust read an article about him written by a French art historian, and he got very, very interested in Ruskin's remark on religious medieval architecture. He spent 9 years immersed in Ruskin, and then he abandoned it, saying that he had to abandon it if he wanted enough time to translate his own poor soul. Now, of course, as Ruskin was not known at all in France, he couldn't use Ruskin openly in his novel the way he was going to use French authors. And he uses French authors in order to flesh out, to reveal the complexity of his own characters. I'm going to give you the example of Madame de Sévigné. Madame de Sévigné, lived in the 17th century. She was a very close friend of Madame de Lafayette, the author of La Princesse de Clèves. But she herself was not a novelist. She is celebrated for her amazing letters. She wrote practically daily to her daughter, a daughter whom she adored, and those letters circulated and were published not that long after she died.
You're tuned to listener-powered WPKN, and this is East End Inc. Author Anka Mühlstein is talking about Monsieur Proust's library.
So it is not surprising that Madame de Sévigné became the French literary symbol of maternal love. And she is, of course, associated in the novel with the grandmother and the mother. The two ladies in the novel are extremely close. And so Madame de Sévigné, in a way, is their idol. But Proust differentiates the way the two ladies read Madame de Sévigné. In the first part of the novel, Madame de Sévigné is in the domain of the grandmother. The grandmother always has her copy of Madame de Sévigné in her purse. She reads her constantly, and she immerses herself in Madame de Sévigné. She reads it as if she were reading herself. It is all about maternal love. It is about how you love your child. That's how she reads Madame de Sévigné. Then the grandmother dies, and the daughter, the narrator's mother, takes over the copy of the letters that she puts in the purse, and actually she even takes over the purse of her dead mother, the muff, the coat, even the appearance of the dead woman. And so she also reads Madame de Sévigné constantly, but very differently. We all know that Madame de Sévigné had a daughter, but she also had a good-for-nothing, lazy, spendthrift son. And in a way, so did the narrator's mother. The narrator takes the whole novel before he sets down to really start serious work. And you know, he spends money like water. He gives extraordinarily expensive gifts to his girlfriend Albertine, much to the annoyance of the mother. And the mother does not really want to confront him directly, but she uses Madame de Sévigné to do so, and she uses it with extreme cruelty. The narrator writes, "She reproached me for my lavish expenditure and told me that she hoped that I would never be like Charles de Sévigné, who was always two person in one and could never choose which one he was going to be. And she also hoped that, unlike Charles de Sévigné, I would not pay without getting out of debt, and I would not spend without having something to show for it." So you see, the two readings are very different. The grandmother is a very pure person, really disinterested, while the mother is a little more devious in her reading. De Sévigné is interesting also in regards to another character, who is Monsieur Charlus. Monsieur Charlus is the most interesting, I think, character of the novel, the most difficult to understand, to apprehend. And the scene I am referring to takes place at the beginning of the novel. We are in the summer resort of Balbec. And there, the grandmother and the narrator, her grandson, are invited by Madame de Villeparisis to a very small gathering. Madame de Villeparisis is a friend of the grandmother's. She's also the member of the Guermantes family, which is one of the grandest families of France. And she is the aunt of Monsieur Charlus. Now, up to this point, neither the reader nor the narrator have any idea as to what Monsieur Charlus' true nature is. He has been described to the narrator by his friend Saint-Loup. Monsieur Charlus has been described as a strong, virile man, a man who likes to walk for miles and miles, swim in freezing rivers, violently repulsed by homosexual, and is a very active ladies' man. And Monsieur Charlus is very forceful, actually alarmingly so, and he frightens a bit the shy and gracious and self-effacing grandmother. Now the conversation suddenly lands on Madame de Sévigné. And Madame de Villeparisis, in a rather sneering tone, says that she finds that the love of the mother for the daughter is not natural. It is exaggerated. The grandmother doesn't even argue. She never argues about Madame de Sévigné because it's part of herself. She doesn't want to argue about it. But Monsieur Charlus rises to the occasion and tells his aunt, "You don't understand anything. It is not who you love which is important. It is the act of loving. And if you don't understand that, it's because you have such a narrow conception of life." Now, this is a very interesting remark for somebody who is actually going to be revealed as a homosexual who feels a certain guilt about it and doesn't advertise it, at least at the beginning of the novel. But something else happens. While speaking of Madame de Sévigné, Monsieur Charlus's voice changes, and he suddenly has a contralto. The narrator says it's like a contralto voice that has not quite been trained. So it's very high. You have the feeling you listen to a woman, and then it goes down to a man, and you have the feeling of a conflicting duet of voices. And this is exactly what Monsieur Charlus is about, because he is absolutely torn by the contradictions of his deep sensitivity, which is revealed by Madame de Sévigné, and his violence. violent outbursts. Charlus is such a complicated character that actually Proust needs three writers to sort of catch the different layers of his personality. Madame de Sévigné, we have seen, to show his sensitivity. But then you have Saint-Simon. Saint-Simon is the memoirist of the court of Louis XIV, and his work stretches over 40 volumes. And he left a very, very detailed description of the life at Versailles. Now, Charlus is a man who is absolutely obsessed by rank, by privileges. He has the sort of unshakable conviction that he is at the apex of French society, but he suffers because he understands that sometimes his this position could be altered by people who don't have any idea of who he really is. Saint-Simon is like that in regards to the position of dukes. Saint-Simon had the feeling that dukes, the position of dukes, which were dukes were supposed to be sort of number one in the ladder, but they were attacked by Louis XIV and his bastards, and so he was always in a state of rage, Saint-Simon. So when Charlus gets into those sort of rants, he's absolutely inspired by Saint-Simon. And Saint-Simon inspires one of the most comical scenes of La Recherche, which happens early in the novel also, when Charlus is invited by Monsieur and Madame Verdurin. Monsieur and Madame Verdurin are bourgeois. They have absolutely no idea of what are the prerogatives of nobility. They have no idea, and they invite Monsieur Charlus. Do not give him the place of honor at that table for the reason that he is only, in their eyes, only a baron, while there's also a marquis there, an obscure provincial marquis. Now, the third writer, which is very important to Charlus, and very important in order to reveal Charlus, is Balzac. Monsieur Charlus is the great Balzac specialist in the novel. He adores Balzac for the reason that Balzac is acquainted with even those passions which the rest of the world ignores or studies only to castigate them. Now, this is important because Proust himself was quite worried about the reception that the homosexual theme in his book would get. He was so worried that he wrote over and over again to his publisher, warning him, telling him that Sodom and Gomorrah, one of the volumes of the series, was rather indecent, and he wanted to make sure that Gallimard would continue the publication even if the public sort of resented it. And at one point, he even thought of putting himself under the protection of Balzac by the way of introducing a footnote, which would have been a quotation of Balzac, on what Balzac called the third sex. But Proust realized that this would be awkward, and instead of doing that, he sort of adopted a certain characteristic of one of Balzac's great creations, which is Vautrin. Now, I don't know if you all know who Vautrin is, but in Father Goriot, Vautrin is an escaped convict who wields amazing power on the underclass because he is the unofficial banker, and he is entrusted with the proceeds of all the burglaries and crimes, and he distributes the funds as he sees fit. And Vautrin does not like women. He likes handsome young men. And Balzac makes no bones about it. You are just told that practically at the beginning of the novel. And I think that this portrayal of a mature homosexual sort of gave courage to Proust. And so he gave Charlus many, many traits that Vautrin has. For instance, the two men have the same physical build. They have the same piercing look. They both are very feared in their milieu. Balzac says that Vaux transposition in the underclass was that of a duke and peer in high society. Of course, Charlus is also feared in his milieu because he can make or break the reputation of somebody with a nasty or a benevolent remark. Both men are violent, and both men have the same way of seducing young men. But you have these resemblances are actually rather external. You do have the impression that Proust took the outer envelope of Vautrin and poured in it a completely different character, if only because Vautrin is not at all troubled by his homosexuality, while Charlus is really tormented by guilt and by shame.
This is East End Inc. We heard Anke Mühlstein talking about her literary biography, Monsieur Proust's Library, published in 2012 by Other Press. She spoke at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor. Ms. Mühlstein's other works include Baron James, The Rise of the French Rothschilds, a biography of her ancestor, James de Rothschild. Also, Balzac's Omelette, and with husband Louis Begley, Venice for Lovers. Here are some upcoming literary events on Eastern Long Island. The Poetry Place at 58 Waverly Avenue in Patchogue presents a series of workshops on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and readings at 8 p.m. Poets Deborah Hauser and Jim Papa will read on April the 30th. More information is available at 631-730-3545. On Friday at 7 p.m., LTV at 75 Industrial Road, Wainscott, presents the first annual poetry affair featuring East End poets, including Rosalind Brenner, Fran Caston, Monica Enders, Lucas Hunt, Michelle Murphy, Tammy Nuzzo-Morgan, Christina Rao, Julie Sheehan, and Grace Shulman. The event is free. Donations accepted for the East Hampton Food Pantry. Free literary events at Canio's Cultural Cafe, 290 Main Street in Sag Harbor, include on Friday, April the 25th at 6 p.m., a short talk on writing long with novelist Ed Hannibal. On Saturday, April 26th at 5 p.m., biographer and literary critic Susan Schillinglaw speaks on John Steinbeck and his great works. On Saturday, May the 10th at 5 p.m., James McMullen presents his illustrated memoir, Leaving China, An Artist Paints His World War II Childhood. East End Inc. is heard on the fourth Wednesday each month at this time. The programs are archived online at eastendinc.blogspot.com. East End Inc. is heard because you support this listener-powered radio station. Please go to wpkn.org to donate. Thank you. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Soka. This is Hazel Kahn.